Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
On your mobile, on your wavelength, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republican, Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. Well, we've reached the end of another week and it's been quite a week, hasn't it? There's been an awful lot to talk about. There's been an awful lot of numbers actually put out there. So statistics have been the order of the day, if you like. We just had Jeremy Hunt making a speech setting out the five priorities. The same five priorities, by the way, that Rishi Sunak came out with just a couple of weeks ago. Apparently, what we're going to do is put the letter E in front of every one of them as well. But I'm not quite sure why he's done that. But he's going to halve inflation, he's going to make growth happen, he's going to stop the boats, that's actually the fifth thing, he's going to reduce the NHS waiting time. I can never remember what the fourth or the fifth one is, but anyway, that's what he says he's going to do. We've got Kate Hoey, Baroness Hoey no less, who's going to talk to us about that. But also, we have had these statistics this week. The one I think that was probably the most stark was that there was one death every 6 days, one murder every 6 days by somebody out on probation. A criminal who was out on licence every 6 days murders an innocent person in this country. Today, we've got an even more remarkable and incredible statistic, which is that the people smuggling gangs in the past year alone, according to data collected by the French government, have made £183 million, right? That's right. £183 million. We've asked the question regularly on this show, can we find any government department that's actually fit for purpose, that's working properly? The NHS? Not really. The Border Force? Not really. The Metropolitan Police and the rest of the police forces in this country? Not really. More or less any government department you care to look at, the Department for Work and Pensions, HMRC, anything at all that has the taint of public sector working on it doesn't seem to work terribly well. But we finally found something that works brilliantly. Because in 2018, they only made £1 million, the people smugglers. They've now made £183 million. That's from about 45,000 people coming. We're told that this year it could be as high as 65,000 or even 80,000. So they'll make even more money. Jeremy Hunt says he's going to stop the boats. Well, how is he going to stop the boats? We'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about HS2 as well, which, guess what? It's now beginning to sound a bit like the trams up in Edinburgh. When they built the trams, they said they were going to go all the way from the airport all the way down to Leith. And then it didn't happen. Well, HS2 was supposed to come all the way down from Birmingham into central London. Now, they're saying it might stop in West London. I mean, I don't know why they'd need to bring it into central London, to be honest, because it's already coming straight down towards like somewhere like Shepherd's Bush, Wormwood Scrubs around there. Apparently, it's not going to come all the way into London, despite the fact that it's over budget, despite the fact that it's cost billions and billions and billions and billions of pounds. It's simply not working. What a surprise. But finally, as well, the other thing that's not working, we said this over Christmas, the Royal Mail, loads of people still waiting for Christmas cards and Christmas presents because 60% of people were affected by all the Royal Mail strikes. Deliveries from places like Evri, Hermes, whatever company you wish to talk about commercially, not working. We've got an amazing story from Bournemouth today about a couple who ordered a sofa. The sofa was delivered to their house. The people who brought it in got it stuck halfway up the stairs. But instead of finding a solution to what to do, having completely wrecked the inside of the house, knocking holes in the wall, damaging the banisters, they just left it. They said, oh, we've got to go. So we're going to take your stories today on moving horror, delivery horror, shocking states of affairs. We know that an awful lot of people who are supposed to be getting a delivery from Amazon or somewhere else simply don't get it. They never see it. It never gets to them. We'll be talking about that, plus much besides. Don't forget, Plank of the Week tonight, 7 o'clock. Don't miss that. 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is the Independent Republican, Mike Graham. Let's get it on. very good morning to you, and apologies if my voice sounds a bit scratchy, but I've got a bit of a cold, and I know that, you know, nobody cares really, and neither should you, and it's a bit of man flu, so I'm not going to make a big thing of it, but I do feel a bit rough. So if I launch into a coughing fit at any point, I'm afraid it will be down to my amazing guests, like Kate Hoey, to speak on my behalf. Kate, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
I've managed to avoid the lurgy until now, and it's finally got me. So I did all right, but here we are anyway. So hopefully, if I start coughing madly, then if you don't mind picking up and just talking on my behalf, that would be brilliant. Let's start off with Jeremy Hunt, I guess. What did you make of his optimistic speech? He's talking about lots of words beginning with E. He's got the same five priorities as Rishi Sunak. All very, noble, I suppose. But how's he going to do it?
Well, I haven't heard the full speech, and I've only heard the sort of reports of it. It does seem like he's sticking to these five priorities that Rishi Sunak came out with. And of course, I don't want to go into it now in great depth because you're fed up hearing me talking about it. But, you know, there wasn't one single mention of the big row with the EU over Northern Ireland. And no. I think that's very, very annoying. I would have liked them to be announcing that they weren't going to go ahead with putting up corporation tax, that they were going to look at actually reducing tax for the lowest paid, and in other words, allowing people to earn more before they have to pay tax. You know, I think everything just seems to be the wrong way round, and that we're going back again to the way they tried to do things, you know, years ago, this old-fashioned idea of economics. I mean, I appreciate we have to make savings, but somehow the way that you make savings, I don't believe, is by making the poorer people pay more. And then at the other end, start putting in more help and support for those poorer people. So it's kind of, you know, it seems to me not very common sense approach. But also, you know, this whole question of, you're probably going to talk about it to more experts later on HS2.
Yeah.
I was very, very pleased looking back. You know, sometimes you look back on your record and you realize how many times you voted against something that everyone thought you were mad to vote against. And then later on, things change and you're suddenly in the, having done the right thing. And I just think the whole HS2 project from the beginning was doomed. You know, we're not in this country, I'm afraid, very good at doing big projects.
No. And one of the problems for me with HS2 is the immense amount of time that it was going to take to come to fruition. I mean, I think you and I, without wishing to be too dark about it, will probably be long dead by the time the train's actually running.
I was just going to say that I don't think I'll probably not live to see the actual first one go, never, you know, the first bit of it. But I mean, just think of the money that's already been spent, how that could have really improved transport links in across the country. You know, if we'd reopened some of those train lines that were closed, if we did a lot of those things, making people living in communities, particularly in rural areas, who feel quite isolated and have to get, you know, trains are very, very difficult. You have to go a long way to get a train. That would have made a real difference. So anyway, I'm not sure he said anything particularly exciting.
No.
And I don't think business will be waking up thinking, this is great, we've seen a real change.
Exactly right. And I mean, let's face it, while HS2 has been under construction, if you like, the whole rest of the network, the train network, has fallen into complete and utter disrepair and disarray. People who travel by train now tell me that it's more or less a complete and utter lottery. I was speaking to a guest last night over in our studios in West London who had come down from Wakefield. And she said, I said, oh, where have you come from? She went, Wakefield. Are you going back tonight? She said, well, I'm hoping to. But she said, to be honest, I'll get to the station and I won't know until I'm actually at the station whether the trains are going to be running. It's nonsense, isn't it?
And that's happening all over the country. I have a friend who lives down in Devon who's really quite desperately keen to come up to London, but she's getting older and she just knows that every time she makes those plans, either a strike happens or the train is cancelled and you end up sitting on a train for hours. And it's terribly, terribly ridiculous, really, that such a small country, really, as we are, that we can't get our transport system absolutely working perfectly. And, you know, again, it's like a lot of these organisations and institutions, there seem to be far, far too many people at sort of top end or the middle end of management who are making decisions that are not based. And, you know, you were talking there in your introduction about postal, what's happening to the post. Now, I have to say I'm a great supporter of the postal workers because I live in a rural area and we know the importance that good postmen and women do. You know, they often do so many things above and beyond their job, delivering things, passing messages on, all kinds of things. But you know, the management at Royal Mail have just, I believe, set out to kind of almost destroy it. And, you know, when I was younger and was teaching, I used to teach postal cadets. Mm. In order to be a postman or postwoman, you had to be a postal cadet for something like a year and a half, where you were trained properly. You know, they wore beautiful uniforms. They looked as if they were part of a kind of, you know, some kind of service.
Yes. They were a sort of community army, weren't they? And they were always the most reliable. And also they were really good. Yeah, and they were also really good for sort of keeping an eye out on streets. If they saw something unusual, they would be there every day, so they would recognise it. They'd know if somebody wasn't picking up their milk, and they'd maybe alert the police, all of those things. But again,
but if you talk to your postman now, if anyone listening to this actually goes out and talks properly to their postman or postwoman, they will tell you just how many extra managers there are now in those big buildings, how many middle range managers, and what are they actually doing? Because they've never been postmen and postwomen, most of them. They don't know what it's like, and they've changed it. So the postal dispute, I'll just get this in and then I'll shut up, is actually not so much about pay as about working conditions and changing practices and the determination of the Royal Mail to push parcels rather than mail. They don't really want people to send letters anymore. They're not interested in that. They're more interested in the parcel side.
But you're quite right to say it, because we do suffer in this country now from a kind of outbreak of managerialitis. We've got too many managers and not enough people actually know what they're doing. You know, that's why the postal service isn't working. That's why the trains aren't working. It's why the NHS isn't working. It's why the police isn't working, because they haven't got enough people at the front end actually doing the job, but they've got plenty of people in the back office telling them what they should be doing. And you kind of go, well, that's the wrong way around. Anybody could tell you that. It's like me being sitting here and having like 50 people out there telling me in my ear what I should be saying. You know, I prefer if nobody says anything, which is the way I like it, and they generally don't. But, you know, you can't run a business like that, can you?
It's a tick box mentality where in Ireland. Absolutely true.
To ridiculous. Now, let's go to Nicola Sturgeon, because this has been some story this week. You know, Nicola Sturgeon, it seems to me, has completely kiboshed her own, trans kind of law, which was going to be completely and utterly revolutionary in Scotland. It's now in disarray, according to the Telegraph this morning, because she's done what I think we all thought she should do, which was to make sure this trans rapist does not go to a women's prison and instead goes to a men's prison, because I keep saying when the crime was committed, he was a man. He was not in transition. He was not anywhere near being a woman. He raped two women because he was a man, and he should serve his time as a man. It's that simple, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, and rather makes me laugh when they go on about risk assessment. Yeah. Probably there were about 100 people sort of risk assessing this man, woman, whatever you want. But the reality is anyone who rapes women should not end up being in a women's prison. Yeah. It just seems absolute common sense. So why it took all this time to sort that out, and how the prison service itself, now probably they're under, you know, quite strong rules that they have to look at everybody individually as they say they have. But again, how could they have allowed this to happen? And of course it makes her whole policy of reducing the age that you can decide to self-identify, basically. That's what's going to be. It happened in Scotland. Thank goodness the government has stepped in and has stopped it in the meantime, because it is affecting women right across the United Kingdom. And, you know, this idea that the United Kingdom government shouldn't stop something that another part of the United Kingdom, the devolved government, is doing is just mad. I mean, they've got to be able to. They've never used it before, and this time it's absolutely the right thing to do. Mm. So I'm pleased that she's had to draw back on what she was doing, but she hasn't drawn back far enough, and therefore the United Kingdom government's going to have to do it if we want to protect women and women-only spaces. And I feel very strongly about that, particularly because of what's happening in sport.
Yes, absolutely. We'll come back to that, because I think she's definitely overplayed her hand, and she has now got herself in an impossible situation. I wouldn't be surprised if she has to now completely reverse this particular law that she wants to bring in any event, regardless of what the British government does. But stay with us, if you could. Baroness Kate Hurry is with us right now. We're going to talk about the migrant crossings. We're going to talk about women in sport, trans women in sport, of course, as well. Much else besides, as well as the Brexit debate, which is still raging. This is Talk TV. I'm Mike Graham. More after this.
Online, on DAB+, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. I'm very grateful for all of the advice I'm getting on what I should do to make myself feel better. Jade Anna says this. Good morning, Mike. Sorry to see you have the lurgy. Lem slip at work. A nice bottle of whiskey this evening. I'm sure it will cure you. Well, do you know, it used to be one of the cures that I would do was to drink quite a lot of whiskey. I did have a couple of nips of it last night, but didn't seem to do any good. But I'm sure I'll be better by tomorrow. But anyway, never mind. And that's enough about me, as they say. After listening to Tweedledum on the economy and his plans, he has reinforced my opinion that Rishi and Hunt are the Mike and Bernie Winters of politics. They haven't got a bloody clue. Well, that's one for the teenagers, Mike and Bernie Winters. They were a pair of sort of not very funny comedians from the 70s. I'm sure Kate remembers them. But, I mean, it is ridiculous, this whole situation, Kate, where we're facing a massive increase in expense. People are paying ludicrous amounts of money for their energy. And he's refusing, point blank, more or less, isn't he, to reduce taxes in any way. In fact, taxes, if anything, are probably going to go up between now and the end of the year.
Well, I suppose he certainly doesn't want to look like Liz Truss. That's what he's determined not to be.
I don't think anybody can look that bad.
I mean, obviously, Liz Truss went too far too quickly without really kind of getting people to understand what she was trying to do. And I think that, you know, that there is a halfway house here, and he seems to have gone completely in the opposite direction. You know, as I said at the beginning, I just think people on the whole want to have more of their own money to decide their own priorities. And rather than the government making, you know, getting involved in every aspect of your life. So I think he's not really showing yet the leadership that is needed to be prime minister. You know, I don't like to, well, I'm saying it, so it's not a question of not lying to it. I don't think he looks like a prime minister either.
No, it's a funny thing,
you know,
isn't it?
Because internationally,
it's a certain je ne sais quoi, isn't it? And you can't always put your finger on what it is. I mean, Liz Truss didn't look very prime ministerial either.
No.
I was quite surprised at how bad she was at kind of...
I mean, the reality is Boris looked and behaved... you know, he always came across as someone who was in charge, even if he was making the wrong decisions, even if he was saying the wrong things, even if he was sort of doing silly things. He always looked like he was in charge. And even just pictures this week of him going to out to Kiev you know, he looked like somebody who was in charge.
Yes. Well, do you know, he was in our TV studios yesterday. Denise Doris has got a new show coming out next Friday, and she's done an interview with him. And people were genuinely excited that he was in the building. You know, that's the thing.
Well, you know, when I worked with him at the City Hall, it was anywhere you went, it was just like a royal visit.
Exactly, but that's exactly right.
Only less security. And the thing that really got to me is that he, you know, he travelled all around London on his bicycle when he was mayor. Nobody, no support in terms of security or anything like that. He was the best known figure in the whole of the country. And, you know, Sadiq Khan, I think the mayor has a, you know, protection with him. He's always in his car, except
when he
gets a photo op.
But what about Boris? Do you think he could ever come back? I mean, I think his time has kind of passed, to be honest.
I think it's, I mean, he is going to now spend, I would say, quite a bit of time just doing interviews, making money, you know, and all of that. I suppose if the Conservatives lose badly, as it looks like they could at the next election, then they will be looking for something totally different. And I suppose bringing Boris back would not give them that real change. Mm. But I still think that he is the only person at the moment in the Conservative Party who could actually have a chance of winning back holding on to some of those seats that they won at the last election. But I think the vast majority of the public are basically fed up with all the main political parties, I'm afraid.
Yes.
They just see them very similar. You know, Labour and the Tories on most issues, really. They might pretend that they're very different, but they're actually not that different.
And interestingly, one of the things that I've heard a lot this week, actually, with Keir Starmer and with Labour, is that because of their kind of difficulty in defining what a woman is and the trouble they've had with Rosie Duffield and all of that, and Lloyd Russell Moyle and all of the nastiness in the party. I mean, it's become the new anti-Semitism for Labour, hasn't it? I think a lot of voters are saying, if they can't tell me what a woman is, we're not voting for them.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, they're always having these discussions about has Labour got a woman problem? And I always say, well, if the leader can't even define what a woman is, then they've clearly got a problem, a woman problem. And Rosie Duffield has been treated appallingly. And what seems to have happened is that Keir Starmer, rather than stepping in and, you know, sort of almost encircling her with with love and attention and making statements has shied away from this issue. And I'm afraid that's what's got wrong with Labour now. They're onto every little minority issue there is, and taking the lead on that and forgetting that the vast majority of their basic decent supporters just want to see Labour policies that are about the economy.
And you know, they've got strong. They've always had strong women in the party. You were one of them at a time when Labour was a very different party. But you know, where's Jess Phillips? Where's Angela Rayner? You know, where are these women that are very, very vocal on all sorts of issues, but don't seem to be very vocal on the issues of women's rights?
I just don't understand it, because you know, for most of them, they would claim to be feminists and have worked hard, as we all did in our own way, to make sure there were more women. When I went in first, there were only 41 women in the whole of Parliament. So a lot of things have changed, but instead of kind of, they seem to have forgotten that, you know, women are women, and this idea that trans women are women, it's just such a nonsense. And I do believe the tide is turning on it.
Yes. I think you're right. You wanted to mention the sporting situation, because definitely changing in that world, isn't it?
Yes, except that World Athletics, which is Chief Executive Lord Sebastian Coe, they've just announced that they're going to allow athletes who have trans as long as they've got certain level of hormone, and you know that they're actually going to look at it in a scientific way and measure people, and if they live up to the standards that World Athletics is setting, then you will be able to get someone who has trans, who's become a woman, or and even gone through all the, you know, the proper medical assessments and changes, will still will have extra potential. And I don't think young women will feel that they've got an opportunity now. It's really a very serious issue that I think
In the end, isn't it going to be making more sense if there are so many trans athletes coming forward in various different disciplines?
Have their own
trans games, you know, have trans Olympics, have you know, trans Olympics in the same way that you have the regular Olympics, and you have all sorts of other competitions as well. You know, it's not a problem. You have the Invictus Games, you know, for all sorts of
For veterans
who might have injuries, and you have the Paralympic Games as well, you know, for people who have had injuries and who have got some kind of disability or other, you know. So why not have the trans games?
But I do think that this could well be the, I mean, I know Sturgeon, the leader of the SNP, is not as popular as she was, and I think this could well be the bit that really makes her topple over at some stage.
Yeah, absolutely right. Well, listen, great to see you, Kate. It's been too long. We must get you back on more regularly. Thank you very much indeed. Good to see you, Kate Hoey, Baroness Kate Hoey, voice of reason, and a reasonably sensible voice of what used to be the Labour Party. She's now an unaffiliated peer, of course, because the Labour Party has moved and shifted all over the place and is completely and utterly bonkers mad, not least because Keir Starmer and even the women in it can't tell you what a woman is. What's going on? This is Talk TV.
On the app, on your mobile, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republican, Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. Alan in Cheshire says this: Ray, the Jeremy Hunt speech, it will be interesting to see how the government will persuade people who have decided to retire early back into work. The problem is that if you retire early on a reasonable pension, then going back to work means you will probably go into the 40% bracket very quickly. So it will be interesting to see how the Chancellor will be able to make it attractive to go back to work. Whether he likes it or not, if he is serious on this topic, he will have to reduce taxes. Well, I think that's true. And I think everybody understands that. You cannot build growth with high taxes, because people have less money to spend. They therefore buy fewer things. They therefore spend less money in the high street. And so the economy does not, in fact, grow. And the only way that people can make money then is to put the price of everything up, which doesn't really work. We're going to talk to Ross Clark about all of that in a moment. But just before that, let me tell you a story, which is a remarkable story, but it's one that is particularly human, because it's one that has affected, I'm sure, many of you, as it has me in the past, because it's about a sofa, and the sofa that would only go so far, basically up the stairs. There was a couple in Bournemouth who wanted to get themselves a nice new sofa. They were doing up the house. People who now actually are spending more time at home, partly because they can't afford to go out, are trying to make their homes look a bit nicer, right? Now, this guy's name is Luke Ansell. His wife is Eloise. They ordered the bespoke £1,230 sofa, a leather sofa, no less, a white one, I think, And they had it delivered, as you might expect. Now, the guys who arrived, as you're watching the TV now, you'll see the damage that was done. People tried to take it up the stairs. Now, if you've ever had something taken upstairs, you'll know sometimes it's difficult. If you try and take a bed upstairs, if you try and take a double mattress upstairs, it can be difficult. Sometimes they actually try and put it through the window for you. But these guys arrived. They said, don't worry, we're good at fitting things into tight spaces. This is what we do for a living. So what we'll do is we'll move this. Actually, the sofa's not white, is it? It's brown. I thought it was white. Anyway, never mind. So they get it stuck, basically, halfway up the stairs. Not before they've knocked several holes in the wall, scraped it along the side of the skirting, scraped it along the side of the panelling, knocked another hole in another part. I mean, it's a horrendous job, right? But worse than that, they didn't actually finish the job. They got it halfway up and they decided, actually, now it's a bit stuck. So we can't do anything else and we've got another job to do, so we're off. So they actually left. They just left the whole sofa stuck halfway up the stairs. These people had to call in their neighbours. Luckily, they said, we've got some really good neighbours and good friends. And then eventually we managed to dislodge it from its position where it was stuck and we managed to get it upstairs. But I mean, we've all suffered. We did some amazing stories last year, just before Christmas, when we talked about the delivery company and how many of you were having trouble getting your deliveries actually to come to the door because every drivers were like taking pictures of them somewhere else, dropping them off wherever they liked. The stuff wasn't getting to you. But let's talk today about some of the more, shall we say, complicated deliveries that you've done. Because when I first moved back from America, funnily enough, moved into a very small house in a place called Primrose Hill. And it was a tiny little Muse house. It was a tiny front door, tiny windows. And we had all this American furniture, which was huge. Big sofas, big tables, big chairs, right? All very sort of, you know, she stuff. But we couldn't get it in the house. So we had to hire a carpenter who came with a moving company, pay him loads of money, and he had to cut it all in half. Had to cut the sofa in half, had to cut the table in half, had to cut the chairs in half and move them inside the house, right? Worse than that, when we moved the next time, we had to cut them in half again to get them out. I mean, just ridiculous. So anyway, let's have your stories. Let's have your tales of woe about moving things around because I'm sure you've got them. 0344 499 1000 is the number. Let's talk to Ross Clark, though, now author and columnist at The Telegraph. He'll tell us what he made of Jeremy Hunt's speech, the five priorities that he said he had. His priorities are apparently our priorities, Ross. They're also Rishi Sunak's priorities by bizarre coincidence.
Yes, but I think that the one thing that sort of dominates everything, really, I mean, obviously there's sort of platitudes in these kind of speeches, but I think the thing that really matters, the sort of debate that's going on from on the back of this is, when will we have tax cuts? And Jeremy Hunt has sort of ruled them out in the near future, saying, you know, I want no taxes, but we can't afford them at the moment. There are a lot of Tory MPs still who will say, well, you know, come on, we do need tax cuts. We need some kind of tax cuts. It's the only we need desperately to provoke economic growth. And it's the only way we're going to grow as a nation is through, you know, having lower taxes. And, I have a great sympathy for that argument in that we need lower taxes. But I think with this, I am with Jeremy Hunt on the matter that the public deficit is at a more critical stage. Getting control of public finances is the more critical ambition just at the moment. I mean, you've got to remember back, I mean, only last September, finished off Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng when they tried to cut taxes. Okay, they sort of come totally over the top. But the basic problem is that no UK government has balanced the books in two decades. This is a problem began with Gordon Brown. And year on year, we've been piling on the debt and piling on the debt for the past decade. Nobody seemed to care about it because interest rates are low. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Then, of course, interest rates rose. And it's got to the point where this financial year, taxpayers will be paying over £100 billion just to service the government debt. That is just to pay the interest on the debts that we've accumulated. And that's two-thirds as much as we pay on the NHS, you know, I mean, think about it, you know, if we didn't have this great debt burden, if past governments had managed to balance the books. We could almost afford another NHS now.
Well, it's fine, because don't worry, we've got an answer for the problems of the NHS. Basically, Rod Stewart's going to pay for everything because he's on the front pages today saying that he's happy to fork out. It's a sort of DIY NHS now, isn't
that
it?
One out,
if you need anything done, just pay for it yourself.
Well, yes, it's very kind of Rod, but I think he's rather feeding into this fallacy that perpetuated particularly by the Labour Party, that the wealthy millionaires, they've got such broad shoulders, they can bear the burden of all paying for public services and,
Well, I love this. I don't know if you've noticed.
People don't have to worry.
No, well, I don't know if you've noticed this latest argument that gets made now by people on the left who basically say, well, if you have got more money, then you should pay more money for your own healthcare, despite the fact that it's supposed to be universal, despite the fact that, everybody should have access at the point of sale to free NHS healthcare. If you've got money, you should now be paying for it. People are even suggesting that if you've got money, you should pay more for everything. You know, it's kind of a bizarre world that we're now living in, where some Labour Party people are suggesting that even your electricity should be tariffed depending on how much money you've got. So if you're well off, you pay more for your electricity than if you're poor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you think about the NHS exists by consent. And the reason most of us are happy to pay for it through our taxes is because we think it's universal healthcare and it will be there for us when we need it. Mm. Well, if you're going to take that away and say that anyone over £50,000 or something is going to have to pay for their hip operation, well, you destroy that. And people then start asking, well, if the NHS is not there for me, well, I don't want to pay for it.
Right.
And they start resenting it.
Exactly. And why is it suddenly now that the Chancellor, this particular Chancellor, is worried about borrowing money? Because Britain, as you say, has been raised on a diet of borrowing and borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. And when you run out of borrowing, you just invent some money, a bit of quantitative easing. So why suddenly now is that no longer acceptable?
Well, because till a year or so ago, interest rates were about 0.5%. Well, they're now heading up possibly to 4.5%. Markets recently was expecting interest rates to go up to 6%. Well, I mean, that's a huge extra debt burden. And also a lot of UK government debt is linked to inflation, linked to the consumer prices index or the retail prices index, some of the older debt. And, that's standing at over 10% now. So, there's a huge extra burden. What, seemed quite a light burden of debt a couple of years ago, it's now a very serious burden of debt. It's costing a lot of money just to pay the interest.
Yeah.
And we seem to get
into but it's never really bothered them. I mean, we've now got, I was listening to somebody the other day telling us that in the months to come, our debt to GDP ratio will actually be 106%. We'll actually have a bigger debt than we've got GDP. And I can understand how you might be worried about that getting bigger. However, how on earth did they let it get so big in the first place?
Well, we seem to develop this idea, particularly on the left, but not exclusively on the left, that anything that involved government actually balancing its books, that would be called austerity.
God.
As if we're trying to sort of make people poorer.
But we had austerity, but that didn't seem to do any good. It didn't make any difference.
Go wind back to 2010. Britain was in a very, very serious position then. We were very close to what we experienced last September, in that, global investors in government bonds were losing confidence in Britain's ability to pay because Gordon Brown had borrowed so much money. Cameron and Osborne, and with the help of the Liberal Democrats, give them credit, they took it very, very seriously. And for the first few years, there was a very concerted attempt to reduce the debt burden, to balance government revenue with expenditure. But then, as time went on, suddenly the sort of brakes came off and the charges of austerity got to the government a bit, so Osborne started putting back the date he was going to balance the books 1 year at a time, and then Philip Hammond came along and said, "I'm declaring an end to austerity," and then Boris sort of opened the taps on public spending altogether. We got into the pandemic, and then suddenly even the Conservative government thought the role of government is to pay all our energy bills, pay our wages, and you know we've just got into this ridiculous mess where now we think the state is there to pay for all, meet mm. all our needs, and you know the result of that is just massive debt, which has come to a head thanks to rising interest rates.
Absolutely ridiculous. Ross, thanks very much indeed. Ross Clark there giving us the lowdown from the Telegraph's perspective on Jeremy Hunt and his speech. Of course, Jeremy Hunt thinks that everything's tickety-boo. He thinks that Britain is a genius country. He thinks that we can build on our innovation. He thinks that we can build on all of the great things that make Britain great. Well, that's all very well, but nobody's got any money, right? Because we keep being taxed to the wazoo. We are paying literally more tax than we've ever paid in this country since the Second World War. And you need to reduce the tax if you want economic growth. It's that simple. 0344 499 1000. We'll take some calls coming next. And we'll talk some more about the 183 million quid that's just been made.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
By the migrants, and I'm talking about the people traffickers, not the actual migrants themselves. They're not quite that wealthy. This is Talk TV.
Edgy talk, plain talk, unrivaled talk. Mike Graham.
The only radio show you can count on for a proper serving of good old-fashioned common sense. In search of the perfect debate.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
On your mobile, on your wavelength, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Apologies for a slightly croaky voice. The lurgy finally got me. I managed to avoid it through most of Christmas. Well, all of Christmas, really, and all of the new year. But finally, somebody has given me something. But don't worry, I'm stocking up on Lemsip. I've got some Strepsils. I've also got now some lemon and ginger tea, which has been very nicely supplied to me by our very able production team. So I shall hopefully be able to get through without croaking too much. But thank you very much indeed for everything. Bit of breaking news for you here, which we've got, which is a terrible story. I'm sure there will be more developing throughout the course of the day. An NHS hospital trust has been fined £800,000 after admitting failings in the care of a baby who died 23 minutes after being born. Nottingham University Hospitals pleaded guilty after the death of Winter Andrews, who died in 2019. It's a breaking news story, of course, so we will bring you more details on that. Obviously, there's been an investigation ongoing because this happened 4 years ago, and it's a terrible, terrible story. So we'll bring you more on that as and when we can. Also, another breaking news story about Matt Hancock. Speaking of care for the NHS, it turns out that he hasn't paid quite as much to charity as he said that he would. He's only given 3% of his fee for I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here to charity. He said that he was going to donate a lot of money, and that was his defence for going into the jungle. He was paid £320,000 apparently for his 3 week stint on the reality TV show, and he has given £10,000 to two charities. He had previously said that he would donate more than his MP's salary, which apparently is £84,000. So that didn't turn out quite to be so true, did it? So sorry, Matt, I'm afraid we'll have to put you on the naughty step for that, because that means you haven't really lived up to what you said you were going to do. But who on earth would be surprised by that? Scott in Suffolk says, hi, Mike, do you need a chip butty? As you sound like Phyllis from Coronation Street. Hey, Percy, love fancy a chip butty. There we are. We give billions away in foreign aid, and yet we're still borrowing and getting in more debt. Stop foreign aid now, says Simon in Darlington. Had one from Chloe. I had a sofa delivered. They left it jammed at the top of the stairs. I could see how to get it in, but the men were being absolute muppets, so I told them to get lost. My sister and I got it in on our own. Well, that's interesting. We've also got a great picture which has been tweeted to us by Alex, who says, I once cut a door frame out to get a sofa through a front door. Where there's a will, there is indeed a way. Well, well done. Where there's a will, there's a way as well. There is one for people smugglers, people traffickers, because we've got a story from the Times this morning, and we're about to speak to Alp Mehmet about it, in which it says £183 million is the amount of money that's been made in the past year alone by people traffickers. Absolutely incredible number, a massive number. If we could tax them, that would be something, wouldn't it? Let's talk to Alp Mehmet from Migration Watch and find out what's going on. Alp, a very good morning to you.
Good morning to you, sir.
I mean, I've been saying for quite a while, Alp, can we find a business in this country, preferably a public sector one, that actually works efficiently and does well? We finally found one. Unfortunately, it's people traffickers, but they've found probably the greatest method of travel, the most successful, the most profitable. It's an incredible amount of money.
And that's why it's not going to stop, Mike.
Right.
As I think the last time we discussed this issue, I said, I'm pretty sure that until we send out the message that crossing by boat won't work, I'm afraid they will keep coming. Mm. And the number is inexhaustible. And this year, it will almost certainly be a lot more than last year.
Well, it really will. Well, I mean, the thing that really impresses you when you watch the figures here is that only 5 years ago, they made something like £1 million, right? 2018, and they've increased the profits by 100-fold. I mean, that, by any measure, is an extraordinary business. £4,000 per head they're charging.
Well, in 2018, the whole year, and it only really got going in October of that year, there were 299 who came. Last year, it was close to 46,000. So why wouldn't they,
right,
when they can charge that sort of money and having got them here, they get to stay? Of course, they will keep on doing it. And as for Yvette Cooper saying yesterday that she's going to stop it by tackling the gangs, ho-ho is what I would say to that. Frankly, it shows that the political class are bereft of ideas on what to do about this. And what Yvette Cooper said yesterday was effectively to say, I have no idea how to stop it. And I'm afraid that's the way things are at the moment.
Yes, absolutely right. And of course, you know, one of the five priorities of the government, sadly for a lot of people, it's the fifth one down. So I don't know whether they're going to do the other four first, but it is stop the boats. It's a very simple message, but what does it mean? Because I haven't seen any evidence that this government and this Home Secretary is going to do anything different from any previous one.
Well, you're right. So far, I think there's very little evidence. I do say, and just to be fair to Suella Braverman, I think she genuinely means it. Whether she's successful in the end, well, we'll see. Certainly, until we start detaining people, dealing with them quickly, and returning them or removing them, I'm afraid they will keep coming.
Well, exactly right. But here's an interesting question from Jeff, who's texted into 87222. If the traffickers are making this sort of money, you have to ask, where are they keeping it? You can't put £183 million under the bed. And I was listening, funnily enough, to an interview, because there's a movie or a TV series coming out about the Brinks Matt robbery. And people were explaining, who were involved in it, that basically it was such a kind of a groundbreaking robbery, because so much, like £26 million worth of gold bullion was stolen from a van at Heathrow. But not only did it baffle the police at the beginning, but it changed the way the police looked at things, because the gold was taken away and melted down, and it was then resold back into the market. The money was laundered abroad, you know, and suddenly this was an international scandal, an international criminal enterprise, which obviously this is as well. So where's the money going, and are you in any way able to shed any light on where the money ends up?
I wish I could say exactly where it all was. And if we don't know, then you would expect the government to know where this money is. Very clearly, they haven't got a Scooby where the money is. And it's Probably because this isn't a case of a few big gangs, ruthless gangs, actually putting it together. I think it's a much looser arrangement than that, where the money could be anywhere from, frankly, in any country, be it Switzerland, be it France, be it in Serbia, you name it. And I think they've got ways of stashing their money where we can't get hold of it. On the other hand, I think it's perfectly possible that our government, working with other governments, can get a better idea of where that money is and tackle it. But it still won't stop the boats. Until they stop succeeding, I'm afraid they will keep coming. Mm. And even if you arrest, identify a few and take their money, there's many, many more to take their place, and it will just keep going on in this way.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Because what it will also certainly do is provide them with lots of what they might call seed money to continue the process of bringing people from Europe or from North Africa or from the Middle East and wherever it is, other places where they're coming from, and even smuggling people in now from Central America, which seems extraordinary to me. But you've also got this kind of never-ending supply of these very, very hard-wearing dinghies now, which I'm told are made in China. And there's quite a sophisticated shipping route for those to get to northern France so that when they do produce, you know, 50 men, they've got a boat immediately to get into.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's China. There's been talk of boats being produced in Turkey. It can happen anywhere. Who knows? Perhaps it's going on in Russia, for all I know. It's not simply a case of targeting a particular group and getting to the bottom of it. It's spread across the globe, this whole network of people, and there's no shortage of producers, of dinghies, of rafts, of whatever you want and whatever you need all over the place. Mm. They can be quickly put together. And that's what happens, I'm afraid.
Right. And we've been told, as I'm sure you've heard as well, that some of the boats that come this year might actually be bigger, because we know that in the Mediterranean, certainly parts of the southern Mediterranean, they've been using boats that they can get a couple of hundred people on. I mean, if they start doing that, it really does become a massive problem, because it's bad enough now when 50 arrive or 100 arrive, or in the case of just the other day, 1,000 people arrived on maybe, 10 boats or something, or maybe, 20 boats. But if you're going to bring boats with 200, 250 people on, I mean, that starts to become a critical number, doesn't it?
Well, frankly, I'm not even sure that they need to do that. It could be that in northern France, having boats that size might not be feasible, because it will take longer to put them together. And I don't know how they're going to do it, but I suspect that it will become slightly impractical if they've got very big boats. Mm. We'll see. Even with the boats that they've got now and getting 50 or more into each boat, they're still going to be making a hell of a lot of money. Yeah. And while they're making that sort of money, why should they stop?
Well, quite. I mean, I wonder whether it's easier in a way to kind of battle the if they do start bringing larger boats, whether it's easy to turn those around, because they might be more perhaps seaworthy, but then they might not be, because we also see those things capsizing occasionally in the Mediterranean, don't we?
Well, frankly, if they put together boats that take 200 people, at some point we're going to lose 200 people when these things capsize, as they will do. Mm. I mean, the channel is not the Mediterranean, frankly, and it's bad enough in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
My worry is two things, really. One is that they're going to continue coming, but so long as they are able to rid themselves of their documents or destroy their passports, any other identity documents, and get here, and then we wring our hands, say, what on earth are we going to do about this, and let them stay on. And as happened with this guy, Abdul Rahim Zai,
yeah,
who it took 2 years to provide the evidence that he was 19, not 14 when he arrived.
Yeah.
That's senseless. That's absolutely bananas, frankly, it should take some... When you see someone, I mean, you tell me if you can look at a youngster, a 14-year-old, and believe them when they say, I'm actually... more than that, or I'm less than that.
Yeah.
If you see a 14-year-old, frankly, they look like a 14-year-old.
Exactly.
And if you see a 19 or 20-year-old, well, frankly, they look like 19, 20-year-olds. They've got a beard. In some cases, they may even be having a receding hairline.
Yeah.
It's so obvious. And yet, officials' hands are tied. They are hamstrung. It was only a couple of years ago when Priti Patel was Home Secretary that the instructions and guidance to officials dealing with cases was that if there was any doubt that they were not over 25, then they should be given the benefit of that doubt.
Mm.
And I mean, that doesn't make sense. It's certainly not common sense that this programme is famed for.
No, you're absolutely right. Alp, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Alp Mehmet, Chairman of Migration Watch there, just saying, it doesn't make any sense, does it? And they're never going to stop this ridiculous toll for the people coming to this country. If the money they're making is this big, why would they stop doing it? They won't. 183 million quid last year alone. Extraordinary stuff. Coming up, we're going to speak to Professor Andrew Tettenborn, writer for The Spectator, Professor of Law at Swansea Law School. He's going to talk to us about the ever-increasing reach of local mayors and local towns to try and use their powers to stop you from driving around. Ulez, Oxford, Bournemouth, it's happening everywhere. Manchester next. This is Talk TV.
Online, on DAB+, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Don't forget, we're still talking about deliveries and the problems that you might have had in addition to Jeremy Hunt. I had a wardrobe delivered and they said they could not get it upstairs, says this texter. I told them to leave it downstairs and then I gave them a tenner and lo and behold, they managed to get it upstairs. Hi, Mike, says Roy. Saw Jeremy Hunt's statement this morning, spotted his deliberate mistake. He'd got the right answers just in the wrong order. I think his list was upside down. And as for your war on woke, totally agree. These people are very clever at hiding behind others when instigating their crackpot ideas. They need flush out and putting on the spot to explain by top people like yourself. Keep the faith. Roy, this is what we do here. We try and cut through with the sword of common sense. You remember that statement that was once made by Jonathan Aitken about the sword of truth and the shield of fair play? Well, we don't have any of that, but what we do have is the sword of common sense, which we will slice through anyone who tries to tell us that they've got a better idea than we have about how to run the country. Let's talk now to Professor Andrew Tettenborn, who's a professor of law at the Swansea Law School, because he's got an idea as to how we can fight back against these ULEZ nutters, the eco-maniacs who want to stop us from driving around and make it more and more expensive for us to actually get in a car and go anywhere. Professor, a very good morning to you.
And a good morning to you, Mike.
Forgive my sort of sniffling. I've got a slight cold, which I haven't been able to fight off, I'm afraid. So I'll try not to cough too much as we discuss this. One of the problems that's happening at the moment is that the motorist is seemingly under siege, isn't he? I mean, wherever you go, whether it's London, whether it's Oxford, whether it's Bournemouth, Manchester, everywhere we now have as sort of, you know, places of human habitation, they keep telling us what we can and can't do with a car. It's becoming more and more ridiculous. But you say the Tories can actually avoid falling into Sadiq Khan's ULEZ trap. Tell us how.
Well, you could have added Bristol, by the way, to the other cities that they're trying to get the motorist on. Well, the question is what you do about Sadiq Khan's attempts to make the ULEZ extend to the sort of leafy lanes of Essex and Surrey, not to mention places like Slough, which is quite frankly a money-making exercise, as far more than anything else. He's very aware that the ULEZ, I think in the last 3 years, even the existing ULEZ has brought in something approaching 20 million quid.
Yeah.
In payments from people who have to travel in that particular area. the difficulty is, this is obviously an exercise in money raising to get rid of the deficit on TFL. Mm. It's also a very regressive tax, if you look at it. And this is actually one of the political arguments against it. It's a regressive tax aimed at those who can't afford fancy cars that would be allowed to go into the ULEZ for free. It's a tax that goes to, you know, the plumber, the florist, the roofer, the builder in somewhere like Slough or even somewhere like Havering.
Yes.
Who's now going to be faced with a tax of something like 50 quid a week in order to be able to use his van. And, of course, that's partly going to be passed on in increased prices to people who use his services, and part of the loss will be borne by him. But the point I'm making is that this is fundamentally a political argument. We have to shout loud and long that what Sadiq Khan is doing is trying to show who's boss and trying to raise money in any way he possibly can. The way not to do it is to challenge it legally.
Yes.
There are a couple of reasons for that. One is that, well, my spies tell me that there isn't an enormous chance that the legal challenge will succeed. Mm. I may be wrong about that. It's God's own job to foresee the result of a judicial review.
And is this between the individual sort of, you know, boroughs that are challenging it and the TFL organisation? Is that the review you're talking about?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I think they're more likely than not to lose. And, you know, your person just getting by who lives in those boroughs isn't going to thank them for spending what could be a seven-figure sum of his money on a sort of quixotic exercise in legal challenges.
Right.
There's another point, too, which is a much more principled point, which is I'm not sure whether judges ought to be taking decisions on what are fundamentally political matters anyway.
Yeah.
Because, you know, well, look forward 3 years. If we have a Labour government, we need to be able to attack them politically. We don't want simply to be relying on judicial review and that sort of thing.
I mean, isn't it right to say as well, by way of an argument, that actually this particular plan is not really designed to save the planet? It's not actually going to result in less emissions. What it is going to result in is more fines and more people paying money into the coffers of the TFL organisation. So it's all about raising money, right?
I strongly suspect that it is. Actually, it may even have an unexpected effect. Imagine that you're in, I don't know, Havering, and you want to go off to Harrow for the day.
Yeah.
Now, currently, you can go to the station and take a non-polluting train
from
TFL. As from August, you'll be charged £12.50 if you so much as start your car in Havering.
Mm.
You're just going to say to yourself, well, I'm going to be charged £12.50 anyway. I might as well be hanged for a sheep as for a lamb.
Yeah.
I'll drive the whole ruddy way and save the train fare on TFL, because remember, TFL fares are also going up.
They are.
So I think actually this is likely to be counterproductive at the end of the day. You know, it's all very well to say, well, you know, this is going to save the lives of so many children, which, frankly, we don't
absolute
know.
Rubbish. Yeah, absolute it's rubbish. Also, the installation of the congestion charge has led to one thing and one thing only, and that is more congestion.
To a large extent, it has. And, of course, it's led to congestion just outside ULEZ areas, because I noticed that. Not actually in London, but in another city. One of my children lives in that city. Mm. She is just outside the congestion area, but I had to drive a long roundabout way to get to her to avoid going through it.
Mm.
And of course, all it means is that people who have the misfortune to live 100 yards outside the congestion area.
Right.
One, are going to have people parking in their roads. Two, are going to find their roads, in any case, 24-hour car parks.
Yes. Well, don't worry. They've got an answer for that. We've got to listen. We must get you back on, Andrew, because we're out of time, unfortunately. But there's obviously much to discuss here, because, of course, the answer to all of that is, once they start filling up the roads around you, is they start putting in residential access passes, and you have to actually then pay to park your car in that road, and they make even more money. Absolutely ridiculous. It is totally a cash cow. Having a car now means that not only are you paying to have the car, you're also paying everybody for driving it. You're paying the local council. You're paying for a car parking space. You're paying for the pleasure of going into a congestion zone or a ULEZ zone. It's absolutely shocking. Professor Andrew Tettenborn from the Swansea Law School. Thank you very much indeed. We've got much more to do. Plenty of you to talk to, of course. And we'll be doing that coming up after this. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Now, I said I was going to try and cheer you all up. Well, it hasn't worked out quite as well as I would have thought, because unfortunately now we're going to talk about how the doomsday clock has marched on, and in the last few days we've moved ever closer, actually, to doomsday. Now, you might not know what the doomsday clock is, so luckily we've got James Hartfield here. James, very good morning to you.
Good morning.
Author and historian, writer for Spiked Online as well. First of all, to explain what the doomsday clock actually is, when was the doomsday clock sort of invented?
Well, in 1947, the scientists that were working, atomic scientists on the Manhattan Project, felt a responsibility, a guilt maybe, about what they'd done.
Because they created mass destruction, presumably.
They had. They were out to defeat Japan originally, right. But they worried about what it would mean. And so they've got together a couple of times a year for the last 60, 70 years to estimate how close we are to doomsday, which they do like scientists, you know, they add up.
Cheery kind of thing to do, isn't it?
I guess it felt bad.
Is doomsday technically mutually assured destruction? Is that what it is?
Well, they started before there was a nuclear, a Russian nuclear deterrent. They were just in the abstract looking at the question. But they did get more concerned, and the world was concerned in the era of détente and the two arms arranged against each other.
Right.
There was a lot of anxiety about what that would mean. Mm. And, you know, I guess they played a role lobbying for diplomacy. That was what they were really doing. I don't think we should take it too literally.
No.
I think you shouldn't take it literally at all, because otherwise... I mean, those 90 seconds are up.
Well, is it 90 seconds now?
Yeah, well, I think we were on 100 seconds, and then they moved it another 10 seconds.
What was the furthest away it ever was when they first started it?
Well, they did move it back at the end of the Cold War, rather wisely. They moved it back at about 17 minutes.
Okay.
So it's been... But I think it's worth saying that it's not real. You know, it isn't. You know, we haven't got 90 seconds to live.
No, it's a bit like the 45-minute warning from Alistair Campbell, isn't it? No, that wasn't true either.
Well, yes, and in the same way, it's a way of getting your attention.
Yeah.
You know, I think the scientists are serious, but they're also trying to get people's attention by using this symbolic emblem of the danger we face.
Right. And so, I mean, where is that doomsday clock? I mean, we've just seen, looking at it, there is an actual sort of what looks like a quarter of a clock, if it's not a real clock. Is there an actual clock somewhere?
I mean,
they should have one, shouldn't they?
They should have one, but I think they're just symbolic devices.
Right.
People often do it, you know, it's a common way of grabbing your attention.
Yeah.
You know, hellfire preachers used to do it.
Yeah.
They would say the apocalypse is here, so you must all stay in the church.
Yes. Well, Labour Party does it, don't they, when they go 24 hours to save the NHS. They do that every year.
Every election time.
Right.
And amazingly, it's always here.
Incredibly so, a bit like the doomsday clock. So, I mean, how far has it been away from midnight at its most sort of far point? At which point was it? I mean, has it ever been just at like, a, you know, 11 p.m. or something?
I think they were always trying to illustrate the point from 1947 on. But 1947 is when it was furthest away.
Right.
And like I say, they did. They don't usually move backwards. I think that's one of the mistakes of the way of talking about it, is that everything just seems to get worse.
Right.
So you don't. I mean, and obviously, if you're counting nuclear warheads, people tend to stack them up. It's quite rare that they put them away.
Yeah, I wonder whether people have a different view of nuclear warheads now. You know, younger people, because we kind of grew up with the Cold War in a way, the kind of the threat of nuclear weapons being fired. We used to see nuclear weapons being put on, into places. I mean, I remember driving up and down the country. We used to get a holiday in Scotland, you'd see a big sort of missile being driven on the motorway, and you kind of go, is that a nuclear missile? But you never really knew, but it was kind of in your head, wasn't it? It was part of your sort of psyche. And certainly when before the Gorbachev years, you know, the sort of Reagan years and Star Wars and you know, the space race and all of that, you were very much aware that there were nuclear buttons that could be pressed.
Well, it was the issue, and it governed diplomacy and how the world was divided up. I had friends who camped outside Greenham Common because they thought the cruise missiles would be launched from there. And of course, it's not absurd, you know, in the same way that nuclear scientists are not making an absurd point when they say Russia is a nuclear power. This war in the Ukraine's got a lot of danger in it. But I guess modern day people are more likely concerned about other kinds of doomsdays, you know, and the nuclear conflagration has got to compete with climate change or poisoning the seas. Yeah. You know, there are a lot of...
Do you think people just like to have something to be frightened of?
I guess that political leaders and religious leaders often worried that they're not really getting their message across, and they're tempted to make the point more stridently maybe than they should. And you know, so climate change is a real thing, but just how destructive it would be in the next 10 years is
well, that's the thing, isn't it? People believe things. People think that, you know, if we don't do something by a certain date, that, you know, the earth will kind of self-destruct. I'm not one of those. I don't think that's anywhere near happening. Equally, I don't think that Vladimir Putin will fire a nuclear weapon in a massive way. However, he might use some kind of tactical nuclear weapon. People talk about that quite openly now, who are kind of, you know, strategists in war. They say, well, maybe, and because people were saying to me, you know, actually, we say tactical nuclear weapon, but if he was to fire one, it's actually quite big. It's not a small thing, and it would be just as bad as any of the old-fashioned nuclear weapons being fired.
Sure, and people make stupid decisions when they're under pressure. And, you know, it does feel like a lot of his escape routes are closing off.
Yeah.
I think that it's quite a dangerous situation in that way. But I think, generally speaking, we ought to be cautious about sounding the alarm, because it really doesn't have the effect that people think it does. It does galvanize attention for a while, but it demoralizes people over time.
Yeah,
there's interesting studies about what fear of climate change does to young people. Psychologists have looked at this, and whilst it's true that a minority become very active and want to do things, many other people just feel demoralized and fearful. And, you know, psychologists used to look at what young people, what their nightmares were. In the 1960s, people had nightmares about the nuclear Armageddon. But now lots of young people are telling psychologists, you know, children, that they're terrified of
because
climate
change. Yeah, because people are terrifying them. I mean, it's not that surprising, is it?
Yeah, and you know, if you want to make a gripping TV drama or a film, the end of the world is pretty compelling.
Well, do you remember Al Gore and his famous movie that was banned from being played in schools because he called it An Inconvenient Truth, and it turned out to be an inconvenient pack of lies, and a judge actually regarded most of the information in it as completely false. But he was pushing it and going, this is absolutely what's going to happen. And some of the stuff that comes out of the United Nations panel on climate change, some of their predictions haven't come true. But they just kind of gloss over it and go, well, we should be counting ourselves lucky that that didn't happen. And the psychology of it is interesting to me.
Sure, and you know, lots of it was misinterpretation. You know, the IPCC would set out scenarios and journalists would invariably choose the most extraordinary scenario. But usually,
and people would quote them and say, but this is what they say is going to happen. But then when it didn't happen, they sort of didn't mention it. You know, because I remember reading a story back in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, saying that by 2010, you know, Canary Wharf would be underwater.
Canary Wharf would be underwater, and so would Manhattan Island.
Yeah.
Well, they did have floods, but they ebbed away.
But the water went away again. I mean, that's what floods are, isn't it?
And, you know, there have been many of these. In 2007, after the Stern Report, many people said that 2016 would be the tipping point.
Yeah.
You know, and there were in the Guardian newspaper, they had a clock, a kind of a doomsday.
Well, sorry, clock. We now refer to the Guardian as the racist Guardian newspaper because I'm afraid they've just been rumbled by some podcasters.
Well, you know,
I mean, it's not my fault.
Live by the sword, die by the sword. You might say
exactly right. I mean, it's rather ironic, quite funny, really. But I mean, who's in charge of the doomsday clock? Then are there sort of custodians of it? Are there individuals?
Well, it's the bulletin of the atomic scientists. The bulletin is it's the group really, and they're. I mean, they've always been kind of liberal. You know, I'm a liberal myself. Mm. You know, and they've always been in favour of negotiations, so they tend to skew to pronouncements that are less bellicose.
Yes,
they're not right-wing Republicans.
But it's not like somebody has the power to move the clock. Do they have to have a meeting? Do they have to discuss?
Oh yeah,
it?
I mean, they, but it is.
Apparently, the doomsday clock's ticking for us. We're going to go in a minute.
They do have the power to move the clock, but they do it collectively. But it really has just come out of their heads.
Okay.
I mean, they go through the motions of counting.
So they're just mad fearmongers, really, aren't they?
There's no time
for you to answer it, I'm afraid, but there we are. The Doomsday Clock is coming up to midday. Thank you very much indeed. That was interesting. James Hartfield there, writer, author and historian. It's very close to midnight, but not as close as you think. This is Talk TV.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the independent republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio, via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The independent republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.